The headlines: Iran's top security official says no deal will ever stop the country from maintaining and developing its peaceful nuclear achievements. The Pentagon deploys to Germany the first batch of soldiers meant to reinforce NATO forces against a possible conflict with Russia over Ukraine. Plus, China advising the U.S. to be more flexible towards North Korea as it votes down Washington's proposed statement against Pyongyang's missile launches at the Security Council. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisun Shahmadi. Iran's top security official says his country has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities and achievements. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani says no agreement can deny Iran its right to research and development, as well as the security to deter evil acts. His comments come as Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal are engaged in talks in Vienna to revive the accord. The deal was put in a limbo after the U.S. left in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. On Friday, Washington restored a number of sanctions waivers, saying the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. Iran has time and again said the Vienna talks should result in the full removal of sanctions. Tehran-based political analyst Mustafa Khoshchashm joined us with his take on the U.S. agenda behind its move to restore a number of sanctions waivers to Iran.
This U.S. waiver is not worth even a penny. It's a deceitful measure because the Americans, first of all, would like to continue this blame game. This is part of the U.S. blame game strategy. They mean to show this goodwill gesture to the world and to the Iranians that we've taken the first step, while this is not the case at all. What Iran has been requesting is a removal of economic sanctions, and the nuclear issue and nuclear undertakings and all issues pertaining to Iran's nuclear undertakings have been a demand by the U.S. and its European allies and not Iran. In fact, the Americans would like very much to shift the discussions and negotiations towards nuclear issues. And this has been a step in that regard in order to prioritize nuclear issues, to shift the negotiations to their own demand rather than discussions, concentrating and focusing negotiations on the removal of economic sanctions.
Moving on, Iran's Sadrist movement, led by top Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, has boycotted talks with other political factions about the establishment of a future government. Hassan al-Azari, a senior official of the movement, says its representatives will not take part in a parliamentary session slated for Monday. No reason has been mentioned for this decision. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi reacted to this announcement. He said, no matter how serious political divisions are, there should be no differences of opinion about the fundamentals of establishing a government. Al-Kadhimi said all political groups should prioritize national interests and act accordingly. Iraq's new parliament held its first session on January 9th, following elections in October last year. And the United States begins deploying additional troops to Europe for what it calls reinforcing NATO allies amid a standoff with Russia over Ukraine. The U.S. military says the first batch of troops has already arrived in Germany. The military says they will set up a headquarters there to support paratroopers meant to deploy to Poland. Poland and Romania are the two countries which U.S. President Joe Biden has ordered nearly 3,000 extra troops to. Washington says the move aims to shield Eastern Europe in the face of a potential spillover from the Ukraine crisis. The U.S. and its allies accuse Russia of preparing to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies that and is strongly opposed to increased military activity by the U.S. and NATO near its borders. Also, China is urging more flexibility from the United States to reduce tensions with North Korea over its nuclear and ballistic missile program.
The key in solving this issue is already in the hands of the United States. U.S. is a direct party to the Korean Peninsula issue. If they do want to see some new breakthrough, they should show more sincerity and flexibility.
The Chinese envoy says the U.S. should come up with more attractive and practical actions that address North Korea's concerns. Han warns Washington to avoid what he calls a vicious circle of confrontation, condemnation, and sanctions against Pyongyang. His comments came ahead of a closed-door U.N. Security Council meeting on North Korea's latest ballistic missile test. At that meeting, the U.S. put forward a joint statement condemning Pyongyang's test firings. But the seven members refused to sign it. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. says Washington is ready to sit down for talks with Pyongyang without preconditions. Andrew Leung, an independent China specialist, has joined us from Hong Kong to talk about the United States policy on North Korea. He believes that in order for the outstanding issues to be resolved, Washington needs to change its attitude rather than strategy towards Pyongyang.
We have been learning from the audit part, the six-party talks, the Trump administration's so-called audit branch. All this came to nothing because the United States hasn't changed its kind of stance. In fact, what it has left the United States is just an attitude rather than a strategy. Now, the United States should understand that what the North Korea is trying to achieve is not to attack other people, because this economy is so weak, and what it wants is to shore up the legitimacy of its regime, by developing its economy. But with all the sanctions and also the threat of force, the North Korea will feel increasingly being threatened. So the message being sent by Beijing is that the United States really rethink its engagement strategy with North Korea, not try to force the North Korean to give up everything, but also be able to give some concessions in return, doing a step-by-step kind of approach.
Toronto becomes the second Canadian city where truckers line the streets to push for an end to mandated COVID vaccines. Dozens of tractors and pickup trucks roll into Toronto's downtown Friday afternoon. They plan to hold a protest at the weekend against mandatory COVID vaccines for cross-border truckers. Some are angry at the entire restrictions the government has enforced to fight the virus. They say Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has exceeded his authority and should leave power. The truckers in Toronto are part of a convoy called a Freedom Convoy, which has already reached the capital, Ottawa. Protesters there have shut down the center of the city for more than a week now. Ottawa police have promised to crack down on what they call an increasingly dangerous protest there. The COVID-19 pandemic keeps taking its toll on the United States, with an overall fatalities surpassing 900,000 now. According to the Johns Hopkins University, over 100,000 fatalities were just added since mid-December. Data shows new daily deaths are still rising, with an average of 2,400. A new wave of rising COVID cases is also taking place, with at least 18 states and Puerto Rico setting pandemic records for a second day. Health experts are now warning Americans about what they call an Omicron blizzard in the coming weeks. They say rising infections threaten hospitals, schools, and other sectors and could heavily impact daily lives. The U.S. has the largest death and case fatalities in the world. Meanwhile, British households have been hit by the news of higher energy bills, interest rates and inflation. The government is trying to downplay its role in making Britain significantly poorer, but the opposition is having none of it. Bianca Rahimi has more from London.
Come April, many Britons will have to choose between heating and eating. Everything from bus fares to mortgages are going to cost more. Interest rates have gone up twice in 7 weeks, and three more hikes are on the horizon as the central bank tries to tackle the situation. The opposition members of parliament are livid, saying the government is incompetent.
He doesn't like it, Mr. Speaker. When children in my constituency go to bed with no food in their tummies, with no heat in their homes, what does he really think is the honourable position of a Chancellor who has just allowed one of his policies directly to be taken in fraud, £4.3 billion of fraud under his watch? Any other Chancellor that I've known would come to the House today to resign.
This week, millions learnt that their gas and electricity bills are going to jump 54%. The government says there's nothing it can do with energy prices going up worldwide.
I don't believe them at all. You know, I'm sure they know. You know, and this is just to put people more in poverty. You know, and it's not right. It's not fair. You know, people working very hard.
When you look at the price of things now, everything going up higher than it was. And that's why so many people on the street, living on the street, because they can't afford to eat or drink.
Oh, I feel like it's government responsible to support people who are in this horrible situation. Because I had a problem this year myself. I couldn't find an apartment because the prices went up crazy twice.
Also causing inflation to rise is supply chain issues, higher import taxes and wages increasing. Brexit, the pandemic and a global energy crisis, a perfect storm for Britain, now in the grips of its worst economic slump in 300 years. But who will have to pay for it all?
On April 1st, the cost of living will be going up £3,000 a year for each household. On the very same day, British politicians will be getting a £2,000 a year pay rise. From this, it is clear that those that are on top of the pile have their bills covered, and it's those on the breadline that will be picking up those bills. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iran had been under the rule of monarchical dynasties for 2,500 years, but 43 years ago, a popular uprising changed all that and opened a new chapter in the country's history. In this report, we have taken a closer look at a series of events that culminated in the Islamic Revolution of 1979 and the leader who inspired and spearheaded that movement.
For centuries, Iran was governed by monarchies and autocratic rulers, and the last dynasty to rule was founded by Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1925. During his reign that lasted for 16 years, Reza Shah replaced Islamic laws with Western ones as part of reforms that drew public discontent. In 1941, he was forced to abdicate the throne to his son, Mohammad Reza. The new Shah maintained a close relationship with the U.S. His government was known for its autocracy and focus on westernization as well as a disregard for religious and democratic measures in Iran's constitution. Mohammad Reza Shah was largely criticized for political corruption and the oppression committed by his secret police known as Savak. He established the service with help from Israel and the CIA. Its main aim, to monitor opponents and repress dissent. Savak's practice of torture and executions of the regime's opponents made it the most notorious and feared institution in Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, the Shah launched a series of reforms known as the White Revolution. Although the reforms brought some progress to Iran, they were met with strong criticism from the public. The opposition to Shah and his white revolution was spearheaded by Ayatollah Khomeini, a prominent religious figure who believed the Shah had embarked on a path toward the destruction of Islam. In June of that year, Imam Khomeini delivered his famous sermon at Fazia Seminary, where he strongly criticized the Shah's policies. After that speech, he was arrested, and that sparked 3 days of mass rallies nationwide, with his supporters saying 15,000 people were killed by police. After spending 8 months under house arrest, Imam Khomeini was released. But he remained a strong and outspoken critic of the Shah regime for its policies, including its close cooperation with Israel. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile for another 15 years. But popular support for him grew even further during his absence. Opposition to the Pahlavi regime continued to spread, with Iranians outraged at a high inflation rate, a widening gap between rich and poor, and the repression of freedom of speech. Anger was also high at the royal family benefiting the most from the country's oil revenues at a time when thousands of poor people were suffering under austerity measures to curb the inflation. Popular rage was further ignited by the death of Imam Khomeini's son Mustafa at the hands of Sadak. His death on October 23, 1977, set off a chain of mass demonstrations that grew in the months ahead and turned into a campaign of civil resistance. To appease the protesters, the Shah regime launched reforms and pledged to do more. However, none of those measures were welcome, with the protesters remaining steadfast as insisting that the monarchy must be overthrown and that Imam Khomeini should return home. The anti-Shah demonstrations started growing in their millions nationwide, despite a heavy-handed crackdown by the military. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his family finally left Iran for Egypt. And nearly 2 weeks later, on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran with a promise to form a government that would have popular support. On February the 11th, the Pahlavi regime was overthrown and the Islamic Revolution emerged victorious. And on April the 1st, Iran became an Islamic Republic in a referendum voted for by more than 98% of the electorate. The period from February the 1st to 11th is known as Dahe Fajr, or the 10-day dawn in Iran. Every year, Iranians celebrate the Islamic Revolution that brought an end to 2,500 years of monarchical rule in their country.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
A museum to wonder and reflect, a prison for torture and control, and a spectacular palace fit for a king. Perhaps one might think that these three places don't have the faintest connection with each other, but it's amazing to see that the thread of time has woven them together to create the tapestry of the Qasr edifice. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. In this week's program, we take you to Tehran to explore a dreadful metamorphosis through time, the history of a palace that turned into a prison. But the story does not end there. The Qasr edifice has witnessed 200 years of Iran's history, the demise of the monarch era, and the birth of a revolution. Now, after decades since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, we bring you the untold stories of those who experienced the horrors of the edifice in its darkest years. Stay with us. Here's the first part.
Teheran. The country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October the 24th, 1978. Tehran, the glass prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the glass prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Ghass Prison. Over the last two centuries, the building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. Tehran, the Ghassr Garden Museum. In 2001, the Ghassr prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Ghassr Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the center of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fat Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly.
تهرانی که ما امروز با این گستره و عظمت شاهد اون هستیم.
During the early years of the Qajar dynasty, Tehran, which was the capital city of the country, was about 6 kilometers away from where the Ghassr Garden Museum is now located in. In that era, this place was a green region with nice weather, to an extent that at the time it was known as Khurram Abad, or a verdant place.
Iranian palaces share a similar structure. A large garden with small brooks running through, a stately summer house in the middle, and a luxurious mansion at the end with numerous rooms for the Shah and his wives. It is said the palace cost the Shah 400,000 tomans, a huge sum of money in those days. Many foreigners visited the palace, among them Samuel G.W. Benjamin, the U.S. ambassador to Tehran, Pierre Amédée Joubert, Napoleon Bonaparte's envoy to the court of Fateh Ali Shah, and Madame Carla Serena. Visiting the palace, Madame Serena was impressed by the paintings she saw there. Writing in her travel log, "The palace has been heavenly decorated, and the paintings done in the most delicate fashion.
In 1806, His Majesty spent 3 months of March, April, and May at this palace. But the glory days didn't last long. During the reign of Nasser al-Din Shah, the palace fell from grace and, abandoned, a devastating flood razed it to the ground. After that, its precincts were used as military camps and makeshift war prisons. But the future had something else in store. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts.
During the Qajar dynasty, prison was not basically like the one in the Pahlavi era. It was a small building made up of 3 rooms and some rooms in the basement. This was the police's detention center during the Qajar dynasty. But with the growing confrontation between the Iranian nation and the Pahlavi regime, the number of prisoners increased and the regime was prompted to establish a big prison.
The Qajari prisons were old and small, more like dungeons than modern prisons, and couldn't accommodate the increasing number of prisoners. Brigadier Mohammad Dargahi, the Tehran chief of police, requested a new and larger prison. In 1927, Reza Shah commissioned Nikolai Markov, an Iranian architect of Georgian descent, to build the prison. Working for the municipality of Tehran, he had designed many buildings, including Tehran's post office and telecommunications and Alborz High School. Markov decided to build the prison in the south part of the dilapidated palace. The prison took 2 years to complete. In December 1929, it was opened with 192 rooms, designed to house 800 prisoners. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison. Under Reza Shah, the gas prison was the only prison in Tehran. In those days, prisoners were kept together without any classification. Many scholars, writers, and poets spent years of their lives within its walls. In the past, there were 2 underground canals that supplied drinking and irrigation water to the palace. Years later, when the palace was converted into the prison, the 2 canals had gushed out to the surface, and prisoners would quench their thirst when the freezing water. Hence the Persian idiom to drink cool water was coined, an idiom with a pleasant literal meaning but an unpleasant reference. Shot in 1958, the footage shows prisoners busy with various activities. The edifice has seen many hard days when Iran, under the boots of Russian and English troops during World War II, was occupied and ruined, accused of being a nest for German spies. They destroyed the country's army, toppled Reza Shah from the throne, forcing him to exile, and made his son Mohammad Reza the king of Iran. The occupying forces took all national resources into their hands, letting thousands of Iranians starve to death. The year 1953 is a year indelibly imprinted on the mind of the edifice. That year, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the Prime Minister at the time, nationalized the oil industry, a success that enraged the United Kingdom and the United States of America. On the 19th of August 1953, in an Anglo-American coup, the Prime Minister was removed from power and many Iranian nationalists arrested. The edifice bore witness to the demise of a nation's hope. Mohammad Reza Shah, who had fled the country, returned a few days after the coup.
اگر اون نهضت به شکست منجر نمی‌شد، عملاً ملت ایران در
It's quite natural that hadn't that movement failed, the Iranian nation would have continued its journey toward its historical perfection in a natural fashion and experienced its local balanced development. But the meddling in the national movement by imperial powers, that is the US and the UK, interrupted the current of balance, intrinsic development in Iranian society.
After the 1953 coup d'etat, the nation's pent-up anger came to the surface every now and then, while the regime searched desperately for ways to curb the situation. In the mid-1950s, a new organization was established with the help of the CIA and the Mossad. SAVAK, or the Organization of Intelligence and National Security, aimed to counteract any security threat to the country. Dr. Javad Mansouri was a political prisoner before the 1979 revolution in different prisons across the country.
بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332
After the 1953 coup d'etat, they decided to have a powerful organization to suppress the Iranian anti-imperialist movement, especially since the movement had continued for a long time and the regime was impotent. So in 1956, the bill was officially put forward and approved in Parliament, and with a design by the CIA, this organization was established. The CIA had even an office in Savak, and all plans, information exchanges, training, equipment were from the CIA.
کل برنامه‌ها، مبادله اطلاعات، آموزش، تجهیزات با CIA بود.
Nipping any protest in the bud, SAVAK planned to round up all political dissidents in the country. A need for more prisons was urgent now. New prisons were built around the Markov prison. One of them was for political prisoners, where a large number of political opponents of different trends spent years of their lives.
دقیقاً بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332 است که
Right after the 1953 coup d'etat, again due to the increase in the number of political prisoners and their inherent difference from criminals, in the early 1950s, a separate building was officially built as the political prison.
بخش مستقل و ساختمان مستقلی به عنوان زندان سیاسی، بخش سیاسی زندان ساخته میشه.
Of those prisoners, some work as docents at the Garden Museum, telling visitors their stories of the hardship they experienced there. Mr. Hossein Khan Ali is one of them. As a political dissident during the 1960s, he spent 5 years in the Shah's prisons.
There was a man in this prison for 30 years, Safar Khan Qahramanian. This man was for a long time in this room. For 16 years since he was arrested, no one was allowed to visit him. After 16 years, he was called up to the meeting room.
He couldn't believe it. He was called a few times and he finally went to the meeting room. When he went there, he saw a woman with a little child and a man with her. The woman called him over. As he stood in front of her in the meeting room, she said, "Father, I'm your daughter. This is my child and this is my husband." Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
در سال 42 بعد از قضایای 15 خرداد
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently.
سازمان موساد به کمک ساواک آمد و موساد هم یه دفتری رو
It was here that the Mossad came to help SAVAK, and the Mossad also established an office in SAVAK and began to train, equip, and exchange information with SAVAK.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Dawood As-Saadi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As-Saadi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
In those days, there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as Shah. But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle. Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
اهل مطالعه بودن، اهل علم بودن، اهل دانش بودن، بیشتر این جنبه رو قبول داشتن.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of SAVAK agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
As سال 50 رژیم شاه برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way. But from 1971 on, They were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری، حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودن، حوصله‌شون سر رفته بود.
One afternoon, it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad, and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused, and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused, and then they gave me a beating. They beat me very hard. Then another interrogator arrived and said, I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow. They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. 1 week passed by, but no one came to release me. After 1 week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akberi. Well, today in this session, inshallah, we are going to discuss about self-knowledge, or discuss ma'rifat al-nafs, which is an important topic. Of course, self-knowledge is a prelude to living a better life. It is so critical and so important to know ourselves, our capacities, our position in relation to Allah, and finally, the goal for which we have been created. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, when discussing a topic such as this, it is perhaps best to begin with its definition and assessment of its importance. Of course, there is no doubt as to the fact that self-knowledge is highly critical and highly important. But of course, if we study this topic from the perspective of the Holy Quran and from the perspective of the riwayat, of course, then we will further understand the importance of self-knowledge. Let us then begin by defining some terms. In Arabic, self-knowledge is called ma'rifat al-nafs. Now, what is ma'rifat al-nafs or self-knowledge? It is knowledge about us. But what kind of knowledge is it? It's not the kind that has to do with knowing our names or our father name or the place and date of our birth, of course. This has nothing to do with self-knowledge because it's just a kind of nominal knowledge. It's not real knowledge. Now, self-knowledge deals with another aspect of our being. It is not related to our physical senses. Of course, it is not related to our names and to our, history. And rather, it deals with the spiritual dimension of our lives. When we speak of the different dimensions of the spirit in our being, we should not forget that the human being is fundamentally and essentially different from other beings. Man is a rational agent and other beings are not rational. That's what, differentiates, or that's what makes the difference between human beings and other animals or other species. And although we are tied to the animal world, we are living in this animal world, and we are very much connected with this world in many ways, of course, we wish to focus on that which separates us from animals and is not found in them. No, we wish to focus on that aspect of the human existence which clearly distinguishes him from other species, other animals, and other creatures. To understand why this topic is of such importance, perhaps it helps us to quote a few verses from the Holy Quran and from Hadith on the subject. There are many verses in the Quran which point to the importance of self-knowledge. One of those verses is found in Surah Al-Hashr, where the Quran says, "And be not like those who forgot Allah, so He made them forget their own souls. It is that are the transgressors." I hear the Lord, and of course in this verse of the Holy Quran, and the Lord, the Almighty, is saying that forgetting Allah, the Almighty, causes us to forget ourselves in turn. And ultimately, it leads us to become transgressors in the eye of Allah. It definitely leads us to transgression. If you forget God, you will end up becoming a transgressor. That is it. Because the Quran says, "Ulaika humul fasiqun," and those who forget God and then God makes them forget themselves, they will be transgressors in the eye of Allah. And there is a tradition that makes a similar point, of course, to that of this verse, but looks at the matter from another angle. Now, this tradition is a very famous one, and it is difficult to find a book on ethics which has not quoted it. Almost every book that you study about self-knowledge, this hadith or this narration is there, and it is so well known. The hadith says, "Man arafa nafsa faqad arafa rabbah." He who truly knows himself has known his Lord. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the Western, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome to your program for a better life. We are discussing Ma'rifat al-Nafs, self-knowledge. Self-knowledge implies knowledge about Lord as well. In the other word, that these two knowledges are somehow interwoven or intertwined with each other. If a self-knowledge is achieved, then obviously knowledge of the Lord, knowledge of God is also achieved. I'm telling you, brothers and sisters, that knowledge of the self, knowledge of oneself, one's capacities, one's abilities, serves as a prelude, as an important step towards living a better life. Because unless you know yourself, and unless you know your capacities and your goals and the purpose for which you are created, then you will not be able to move to achieve those goals and live a better life. So awareness of oneself leads to awareness of the Lord. That's what the hadith says. And likewise, one who is oblivious of the Lord is oblivious of himself. So you can say these two kinds of knowledge are concurrent. They are part and parcel of each other, and they cannot be separated from each other. And there's no doubt as to the fact that if one is determined to learn about one's Lord, then the best way to accomplish this task is to learn about oneself. Now, as I said, there are other verses, there are also traditions, but there is also another verse which I would like to mention you, and I would like to bring it to your attention. And the Quran says in Surah Al-Maidah, يَا أَيُّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا عَلَيْكُمْ أَنفُسَكُمْ لَا يَضُرُّكُمْ مَنْ ضَلَّ إِذَا اهْتَدَيْتُمْ إِلَى اللَّهِ مَرْجَعُكُمْ جَمِيعًا فَيُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ. O you who believe, take care of yourselves. عَلَيْكُمْ أَنفُسَكُمْ لَا يَضُرُّكُمْ مَنْ ضَلَّ إِذَا اهْتَدَيْتُمْ. He who errs cannot hurt you when you are on the right path. So verse 105 of chapter 5, chapter Al-Ma'idah. Now this is one of those verses which also clearly points to self-knowledge. And of course in this verse Allah is telling us to take care of ourselves, to pay attention to ourselves, and to be heedful of ourselves, and that we must be careful about the well-being of our spirits, and that we must be aware of the diseases of our souls or our nafs, because the nafs is so important. And of course the word nafs has been translated in different ways. Some people have translated as soul, and some have translated as self, and of course some have used the word nafs to convey the message. And of course soul is slightly different from the word nafs, so we have problem making use of the proper English term. Now of course when it comes to different levels of nafs, we have different levels. Inshallah, maybe in the following episode we will discuss that. To make a long story short, of course, we have to understand that awareness of our nafs, knowledge of ourself, and knowledge of the diseases of our souls and how to cure them is very much important. And God Almighty Allah tells us that we should pay attention to our duties and those obligations that Allah has prescribed on us and that He has made it incumbent upon us. So, inshallah, we will further discuss the subject of nafs in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land He knows. Every shade of pearl, every cloud.
Hashem, He knows I love you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.